Hey there, Crime Stoppers. Howdy ho, Daniel Markham here, DanielBMarkham.com, with yet another Nerd Roundup. And I'm going to be serious for the next 30 seconds, and I hope I'm not going to be serious after that. Nerd Roundup is here to sort of model the behavior we want to see. And good tech teams are able to sort of kick back over the lunch counter and talk about most dang near anything and have fun doing that. And not only, basically, are we going to have fun, but we're also talk about whatever's going on in the tech world over the last week that we've been interested in, why we think it's interesting, and if it's boring, we'll just say, hey, it's boring, and we'll go on. Thanks for coming by. This week, our guest is James Grinning. James? Howdy ho.
Howdy, Daniel.
Howdy, howdy ho.
Howdy, people.
I had just one quick story to share to kick this thing off. You know, you've got sort of problems being a nerd. I read this heartfelt, verklempt article on lobsters this morning, just about an hour ago. This guy had a hard time with one of the other people in the open source community, and it was very well written. It was heart touching. You know, like I said, it was very emotional. And I look at it and I go, wow, that sure is some cool CSS that guy's got going on. I went and stripped the CSS. I'm like, oh, that's just like the first use of CSS variables I've seen, like in the wild. It's a sickness, my friend. It is a sickness.
Being nerdy?
Yes. They're looking at everything from sort of a technical viewpoint. It's like, you see a plane crash, and you're like, wow, I wonder if there was a software error there. Probably so. I tweeted this morning that the new Audi has over 3 million lines of code in it or something.
I've heard that we're talking about hundreds of millions of lines of code in cars. And, now you think about self-driving cars. The best argument I've heard for self-driving cars, which, you know, kind of, I was looking for one. It's like, how do you trust software? It's always so bad. And then you're going to let it drive your car, and then the guy's best excuse for having software drive cars is, well, yeah, that's true, but people are much worse. Yeah. It's like, oh, okay, you might have a point there.
And once it crashes a few times, they code it out, it'll never, ever crash that same way. So if you die, you'll be dying in sort of a unique... you'll make the news.
I don't know about that. Daniel, I'm not so sure about that, because... you know, when they go and fix a bug, you know what happens when you fix a bug. Bugs come to the funeral.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So. Well, yeah, it would just suck if you had to, like, people had to crash the same way every time. It wouldn't be very good for this tech discussion at all. First link we have this week, and I'm being facetious, guys. First link we have is this artificial life page, which is just freaking awesome. I wanted to download and play with this, and I never had time to do it this past week. This is a GPU-based artificial life simulation. And if you took some of the videos the guy has, it's some really cool stuff here. Let's see what we got here. Yeah. So it's as my friend from the 60s used to say, cosmic, man. Cosmic. Huh. Yeah. It's like, whoa. He's got this whole world of little artificial life forms that move around and do things, and he's got rules on each one, and so that's,
they bump into each other, and do they trade pieces when they bump into each other?
They can. He's got locomotion worked out, he's got eating worked out, he's trying to make it as lifelike as possible, and then watch it over several generations. Isn't that cool? Yeah, this is just awesome. This is like, you know, I know you've probably seen Conway's Life. This is like Conway's Life plus, you know, times 10 or something. It is freaking wild. James will be back in a second. So let me get rid of this video here. My CPU is powered by hamsters. And if the hamsters get really tired, they're sad and it. There you are. So yeah, I was just...
you were gone too, by the way.
Yeah, I was just telling folks that... Now, let me stop this. My CPU is actually powered by hamsters, and if you don't feed the little hamsters enough, they don't run fast in a wheel, and that's a bad thing.
It's a problem. I upgraded to a Ryzen Linux box, Ryzen-based Linux box, to help with that, with a graphics card.
Ah.
Oops, excuse me.
Yeah. So next we have this, and I'll just keep talking. James will come back, hopefully. It's time to break. It's time to break up the Ivy League cartel. And I swear to goodness, I am not anti-college or anti-education. I'm a huge liberal arts supporter, huge technical supporter. I love STEM. I'm there. Humanities, count me in. But dang, there sure is a lot of college bashing and academia bashing. And when you post these things, you go to look at some of the comments from people. Here's a guy that, well, at first he said, you know, is it really true that sons of professors are more likely to be professors? And it is true, like 50 times more likely than the average person. So it's wild. It is a, my stepdad, who fought in World War II, used to say, you know, college is just a pyramid scheme. And, you know, you get in, and the idea is to get other people coming in after you. And I guess it can be looked at that way. It can be looked at as a club that you join just to get good references.
Certainly that's true at some of these institutions. I mean, there's things to learn there, too, but there's, you know, some impractical things to learn as well. But I like the idea of well-rounded. You know, you got to have a lot of different things in your background. A lot of experiences and that sort of thing. You know, my son's a professor, University of Florida, in chemistry. So you've got some other things about research, I think, coming up
yes,
on your article list, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Based on your recommendation, I'm about 16% of the way through that chemistry Great Courses series, which is really good.
Most cool. Excellent. Yeah, I just started. I'm about a third into it right now, and I've been enjoying relearning some of it, and then you know, stuff that I never would have remembered. But now, yeah, it's pretty good. I'm enjoying it too. I'm glad it wasn't too fundamental for you.
No. I tell you, the weirdest thing about it was listening to the professor and remembering like taking the class in high school. That was just like wow. I remember the test question the guy was talking about. It's like really weird.
Yeah, and then you have to imagine the things that he's, because there's no graphics, yes. but obviously he's giving the lecture with graphics, so you got to put your head in and go, well, what did that look like back then? You know, Rutherford's model, plum pudding. And
oh, my God. Yeah, he's going to do four quantum variables, the four shells, SPDF, and a lot of stuff. I was like, oh, wow, I haven't thought of that stuff in 30 years or more. So,
yeah.
Wow. So, yes, I saw this last Friday. I'm like, man, this has got to be a joke, right? So,
yeah, that was great. I was thinking, you know, well, I would have a problem with it. I liked one of the guy's comments below. So this person in their tweet, which people probably can't read, is about somebody that has 10 jobs, right? They're collecting 10 paychecks, and all the employers are very understanding that they don't get anything done.
They're all remote jobs. So he's got like
they're all remote jobs,
10 concurrent jobs, you know, one time. Woohoo!
Uh-huh. He's raking in $1 million a year.
He's instead of a 10X, he's like a 1/10 burger.
Yeah, and then one of the people that commented on the thread, I thought it was hilarious, was, I would do this, but I hate to interview.
Yeah, that's wild. I would, golly gee. I had a guy work for me on a couple different occasions that I wasn't directly supervising, but was working in near me. Who didn't do anything. And we didn't figure it out till they left. Then we found their computer, and then I don't know what they were, had no idea what they were doing, but they weren't working at all.
Uh-huh. That's so, it. Solo work is very productive.
That's just hilarious. So the next one is this. This is really cool. So it turns out there's an academic paper. The French have developed a radar system that can detect any form of stealth tech over the horizon. And
you have to know what OTH means to read the article. Yes. So this is definitely was not meant for us, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a technical OTH, over the horizon. So the trick is they can find about any they can locate any sort of stealth technology, but they cannot track it constantly. So it's a kind of a good news, bad news thing. But that's I keep wondering why we keep running down the stealth road, because I think we're kind of out of room on that. I don't know when we're going to get caught, but at some point they can find you, whatever you're doing.
Yeah, but who's they?
Well, in this case, it would be the French.
So I've got a friend in Florida who's retired Air Force, and he was pretty high up in the Air Force. And you know, so I read a lot of articles about it. And, you know, the F-35 is an awesome platform that no one can see with radar. You know, maybe this will be able to see it. But then, you know, most of the enemies have no such capability. And so flying F-35s around when your enemy, when you don't need it for your mission, right, it's kind of expensive. And so now there's a drive to have this F-16.
Yes, I saw that.
And so the F-16X would be a high capability and able to communicate with the F-35. So you'd send one F-35 out in a flock of F-16Xs, you know, to do all the dirty work, and then you've got this, you know, kind of network in the sky flying around. But pretty interesting.
Yes.
And, you know, people that, as soon as they see the, oh, we're going to buy some F-16Fs, it means, you mean the F-35 is a failed project? You know, and you know, all kinds of crazy reactions
It's not doing well. It's not doing what it was pitched originally as being, sort of the next generation fighter. And now you're talking, the mission you're describing is more sort of a communications, a stealth communications coordination platform, right?
Well, if you need that stealth to fight your enemy, like a capable enemy,
yes,
right, then you need that to rip them apart. You know,
I heard that there's even some demand for prop planes, like the Cessnas and such, because it's in some cases you just don't need that much stuff to go after folks.
Huh? Yeah.
So, yeah, I find this whole I like following the DoD stuff, and it's not because I want to go like invade another country or something. It's that they're always trying to figure out where tech is going to be like 20 years down the road. And I love reading and going, I wonder if that's really going to happen.
Yeah, one of your as I'm reading through your articles last night, it's like, I'm glad people have time to think about this stuff. I can't imagine. I can't imagine just, you know, having this thing. It's like, well, what if? And then somebody does this detailed analysis, as you're going to show us some of them coming up.
Yeah,
like
I was really good at that when we first started, 80s and 90s, and maybe early 2000s. I was really good at watching the tech community and going, okay, 5 years from now, I need to know this and that. And I don't know whether I got bad at it or I just don't give a shit anymore. I think it happened. Microsoft XNA came out, and Microsoft, it was yet another blah, 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 blah thing. And I was like, you know, it's going to be big for about 5 or 10 years, and it's going to die off, and I don't want to play this game no more. And I didn't. And it was big for 5 or 10 years and died off. And after that, it's like, well, crap.
Well, Daniel, you should have done like me and stuck with Embedded C.
Yes. Yeah, there's some real wisdom there. No doubt. That's not going anywhere.
That still has such legs, and it's going to have them for a long time, I think.
I completely agree. So this popped up in a comment on Hacker News a few days back, and it was like, what the hell? what? Okay, so there's a way that physicists are thinking of the universe now, which is the universe is information. Everything's information. So as programmers, we are now, you know, we're, I don't know what you would call us, but everything's going to be code. And so they did this switching particle switch between matter and antimatter, because they also noticed the mass changing. And so the guy said, now we know how much mass a minus sign has. And it's 10 to the minus 41 kilograms. And you could actually figure out how much mass a bit of universe information has.
Yeah, it's pretty light, Daniel.
I guess it's relative, really. But yeah.
Well, then when you start to you engage Moore's law, you look at when, you know, I think that's one of the things they did in this article, yeah. Right? So now if we're going to double the information content.
Yeah, I hear the universe down the street's got a lot more capability than we do. It's a universe gap. I didn't know you could do such comparisons, and it made my brain hurt.
There's probably some assumption down there about, you know, the smallest thing that could be a bit. Is that?
Yes, that's
you know, are they looking at a electron spin or something? What is the deal? What's the smallest thing?
I think there are two questions. What would be the smallest bit, and what would be the thing that is the smallest bit? And so I think they're nailing in on what the smallest bit is, because I think this is actually a real answer here. But I don't think they have any idea what that corresponds to.
Yeah.
Because you know, 10 of the mice are 38. That's way, way down. That's pretty small. It's smaller than those little sea ticks you get. It's pretty small.
That's small, yeah. We'll go with that, being small.
Yeah, really small. Next up is the moons of rogue planets could have liquid surface water and thick atmospheres, and they could even be habitable. So for those of you who don't know, a rogue planet is a planet without a sun. And so it's just a planet going on its own throughout the universe. They think that there are 10 times as many rogue planets as there are regular planets. And so if true, we could be sort of heading toward this thing where we realize that if there is life in the universe, it's probably around, at least around some of these rogue planets, and we can't even find them. We can't discover them because there's no star to wobble or whatever to sort of figure out where they are.
Well, don't they need some energy, though, to feed their life?
They do, and they actually come out ahead because what happens is you get this almost a brown dwarf situation, which is a lot of mass, maybe 10 Jupiters or so, and it's hot, but it's not fusing hot. And because it's not fusing hot, it actually will last longer than like a red dwarf or some other actual sun would. And they're saying not only would it last longer, but you could have a moon in a stable orbit that would be habitable.
And just because of the gravitational effects and deformation warming the whole system up?
Well, something that big would be a sort of a miniature solar system without fusion, and because it would last 100 times longer than a fusion-based star, it lasts longer, and you just have moons instead of planets and scale accordingly. Now,
there's no fusion in a red dwarf, or it's just...
Brown dwarf. Red dwarf is yes. Brown dwarf is almost a star, but not quite, I believe.
Okay. And so stuff is churning around in there, but hasn't gotten around to igniting in a nuclear way.
Yes, and because there may actually be a little fusion. I don't know how the math works, but there's enough churn in there that it will just keep. It's not like a coal in a fireplace would actually last longer than a flame will because it's at a lower level.
Yeah.
So that would be really cool. I'm not aware of any sort of mechanism we have to determine where rogue planets are.
One could come and visit us.
I'm sure one has many times in the past. There's been a star that came by here just a couple million years ago within, half a light year or so.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
What's that star up to these days?
Centauri? Yeah, never write, you never call. Yeah, they didn't come to the door. Yeah, I don't know. But, yeah, there have been stars coming in our neighborhood, and there's one due, I think, another few million years. It's just a long wait for stars, and these would come through and you'd just never even know they were there.
Yeah.
Another astronomy thing here. Supermassive black holes affect the universe beyond the bounds of their own galaxies. And if you haven't been following along here, there is something freaking weird going on with supermassive black holes. Supermassive black holes are found in the middle of galaxies. And for some reason, big galaxies have big black holes and little galaxies have smaller black holes. They're looking now, this research here says that the black holes in some galaxies can actually affect other nearby galaxies. We've known for a while that the rotation of galaxies doesn't work out. Now we're seeing this association between supermassive black holes and like things galaxies do, and so there's something really, really weird there. It's best I got. I doubt it's aliens, but it could be aliens. You never know. We'll go on to the next one here while James comes back up. Okay, there you are. So the next one is another university one, James. It's 15 universities have formed a company that looks a lot like a patent troll. You're either extremely patient or your video has frozen. Okay, I'm going to go with frozen video. I hear the bing sound. So the story here is that these universities have created a partnership together so that they just sort of pay lawyers on contingency to go out and find people using their patents, which is pretty much a patent troll. I don't know if you got a chance to read this or not, James. I think you're back now.
I'm back. I wanted to comment on the black hole.
Oh, yeah, sure thing. Yeah. What did you have to say?
Well, just the beginning, I thought it was kind of, it's always nice when an article starts out with something, or at least your statement was not unusual. It's like big galaxies have supermassive black holes and little galaxies have small ones. That's not surprising. But so the thing in this article, though, is that those supermassive ones...
You know what it is? It's black holes. That's exactly what's happening. I have. All right. Oh, there we are. So what? So you said you know what it is? It's not the black hole and galaxy thing. It is.
Yeah. Okay. Never mind.
You're not allowed to say that, James. That's like it is. You know, I discovered that.
I had to drop off because this connection was bad. But yeah, so you were saying that the bigger galaxies have supermassive black holes, and the smaller ones have small black holes. That doesn't sound too surprising, but that's not the surprising part of this article. What's the surprising part of the article?
It's that the black holes actually influence other galaxies. And so it's not unusual. You can see like a galaxy, say, you know, hundreds of millions of light years away with this stream of particles shooting out, like, you know, tens or hundreds of light years of particles streaming out from a black hole inside the dang thing. These are forces that are, you just can't even imagine what's going on. But it's not that you can't imagine. There's a lot of the physics that does not work out with black holes and galaxies. We don't understand how galaxies rotate at the speed they do. We don't understand. I think the size is not a linear relationship as you would expect with just more mass in a galaxy. There's all this math that just doesn't work with supermassive black holes, and I don't know why.
Yep, so the dark matter thing we were talking about a few episodes ago, a few roundups ago, is related too.
Yeah, it is related. You know, it wouldn't surprise me. I was thinking the other day, if you perhaps the black hole is some sort of dark matter, you know, atom or nucleus, and then the or you know, and then the dark matter around the galaxy is the electron cloud.
And then inside of that,
inside of that, we have a one atom thing.
It's turtles all the way down, right?
It seems like the best thing to answer is just if you say it's turtles all the way down, then they just stop asking you questions. And you so this next was these universities have formed a company to sue people who are using their patents, which is generally considered a very bad thing by the tech community.
Yeah.
So I'm sad to see that.
Yeah, I didn't like this story where the researcher's all self-funded and then doesn't own his research. Seems a little lopsided. I know my son's deal, he does, his research is owned in part by him, so that's a good thing. So he could capitalize on any, you know, discovery that he might make in the field of organic chemistry.
Yeah, it's got the feel... I'm not saying this is the case, but to me, intuitively, it feels like a bunch of administrators sitting around going, well, you know, we have to get some more value out of the research we're doing. What can we possibly do to just squeeze more money out of these researchers? Oh, no, we'll do patent trolling. And the cool follow-up to that is a lot of tech companies also have a huge number of patents, Microsoft, Oracle. But they don't use them. They only use them if they get into sort of a war with another company and they need to settle it. They say, okay, well, we won't enforce this patent. They weren't before, yeah. But like, okay, we'll continue not enforcing the patent if we can get along together on this other issue.
Right, yep. Yeah, probably the most impressive wall of patents I ever saw was at Qualcomm at their engineering center in San Diego. And it was, you know, three stories tall and... you know, 100 yards wide. I could be exaggerating, but it was immense. And each, you know, little plaque up there right next to the other, you know.
Oh, wow.
Pretty amazing.
Have you ever applied for a patent yourself?
Back in the old days when I worked for Teradyne, we applied for a patent, yeah. It was around testing of analog cellular telephone connections. So the company I worked for, what we did is we tested telephone lines. And then at the beginning of cellular, it's like, okay, so how do we get into cellular? And so we were going to try to, you know, see if we could do some similar thing, except, you know, the error doesn't really need to be tested. It's if you're looking for, we would be looking for equipment problems in that case. But, and then digital happened and, everything's got built-in diagnostics. So
I applied for one many years ago and didn't get it, but it was a good experience.
Yeah. My brother has several in his former business around fire protection.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Your brother's in fire protection.
It was our family business. My grandfather was a inventor of the fusible link firehead. It's fire sprinkler.
Oh, the thing
when you look up, when you look above you at any building, you see the little things hanging down. One of the technologies was two copper plates with heat-sensitive solder between them under tension. And when the solder melts, the plates slide apart and the orifice opens and the water comes shooting up. And so that was my grandfather was a co-inventor of that. So he had a patent on that.
Oh, wow.
So if you're watching the Superman movie and somebody goes up and lights one and then all the sprinklers in the whole building come on.
That's your grandpa.
That's Hollywood only.
Oh, really?
Only the sprinkler that gets too hot.
Oh, wow.
Turns on.
I did not
know
that.
All the rest are just because, well, that was boring when the director sees that happen. It's like, no, they all have to come on. So
there's some guy in the back just throwing a switch and they're all.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you ever worked in a shop with Halon fire suppression?
I did an installation of that once.
That's some scary stuff.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah, you don't want to be there if that goes off.
They were all masked up, and the nozzle's like up in the corner of the room.
Yeah.
And when he flipped the trigger, and the knife breaks the seal on the... I think they had a CO2 cartridge in, because they don't want to waste all the halon gas, because it's expensive. But it just blasted out of the corner of the room, ripping ceiling tiles out, throwing ceiling tiles at us and stuff. It was pretty violent.
Oh, wow.
But the fire would have been quenched, so.
Yeah, it'll put the fire out right now. It'll put you out as well. But it they say it's a nice death. So it's a
well, you don't have any oxygen.
Right, but you don't have a lot of carbon dioxide, so you're not struggling to breathe. You just fall asleep and you're done.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Not that I would want to do that, in case any of you are out there. And so as a result of this patent troll thing, one guy was commenting that he was a research assistant, and he saw this remarkable shift in the atmosphere. They laid off a bunch of people, and then they ended up bringing, he just called them machines, manuscript machines, efficient manuscript machines, and just sending them off to journals. And so they switched from actually doing prioritizing real research to like, we just got to get those papers out there, the patents in, and the money coming in.
Mm. Well, there's a huge pressure on publishing, but that's how they get the grants. And if you don't publish and you don't get grants, you're basically done.
Yeah, but it's that thing, if you make a metric and manage people work to the metric instead of actually working for the larger goal. I think we kind of reached that point with the published thing, really.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, as soon as you start rewarding the wrong thing.
Yeah, this open science movement's interesting. I think I'm going to end up coming back to open science later, because if you think about it, really, a lot of things we do as cross-functional teams is very science-related. We have a lot of different experts in different domains, and each has to apply just a little bit of what they have. We've kind of been doing that for a while.
Yeah. I was on a team once that this is the most diverse team. We were making, I was coaching a team that made slot machines. Have I told you about them?
Uh-uh.
So they make slot machines. I won't mention the company, but so the team would include, they want to make the game fun, even though you have no control over it. You want to make the game fun, so it's like, visual thing. And so there's a game designer, there's a couple programmers, there's some testers, there's some hardware people, there's some mathematicians, there's a lawyer. So this is the cross-functional
team. That sounds like a joke. Sounds like then they walk into a bar.
Yeah.
And if you just throw a rabbi in here, we got the whole thing covered.
Yeah, but they had, you know, but they were used to collaborating, so it was like kind of cool to give them some structure that they could work with, you know, in kind of an agile planning approach. And pretty soon they made it their own, you know, so they weren't, they felt no obligation to follow rules, you know, because I wasn't telling them about rules. I was saying, well, try doing this and let's see what happens. And they discovered, oh, you know, well, we really discovered that if we do too much detailed work before we let one of our potential clients try it, we have to like redo all the planning after this point, after they try it. So what we're going to do is plan up to the trial and nothing afterwards. Right. So they discovered that like
on their own
one cycle in 6 months, they discovered, we got to stop doing that. Okay. So they stopped.
Right? The feeling I get from a lot of the stuff I'm reading, and I don't know if it's true or not, is that a lot of departments have gotten to reach this, I don't know, let's just call them software architect stage, where they go off and they have a little team of guys who think they're doing really important stuff, and they self-validate how important their stuff is, and sort of nothing really kind of comes out that people actually use except for them telling us how important they are. And it's like, this next is discover classical art, and there's a whole slew of like free art on the internet you can use in Zoom backgrounds, presentations, some good stuff, excellent stuff.
And that's cool.
And this isn't alone. I think Guggenheim has some as well, and I there are three or four sites that have excellent backgrounds.
Can you send me some more of them?
Yeah. I'll find the one or two, put them on our link page when we put this up.
Hey, who's got good video resources like that that you know you can just pick up and use? Does anybody have that available? It seems like you can't find that anywhere.
Well, you can. Yeah, the thing is people, entrepreneurs have clued into the fact there's a lot of guys doing video stuff, and so anything you search for, fonts, like a picture of a duck, just pick an object that you would want to use. Some guy sitting on it wants like $4 to give you that picture that whatever. It's like, it doesn't seem right to me. What is it? Stock photo? I'll Google for images and I'll keep seeing these stock photo sites come up. And the image looks fine in the browser. I'm like, hey, it's a stock photo. It says it's free. And you click to the site and then suddenly you got this, you know, get one free, sign up now, pay $3. And it's like, welcome to the used car lot kind of deal.
Yeah. Well, Camtasia, you can buy their asset package, which has some good stuff in it. So I bought that. You know, I paid them $100 for to use it for a year or whatever. And I found some good stuff in there. And then got to make your own video, I suppose, for backgrounds, for fun.
Yeah, everything I do here I put together on my own. Even if I could pull something off the web, I will modify it and change the colors and change the format and all that. So it is. I don't think I have anything I've pulled directly, aside from these web pages, and just plugged right in.
Well, they've got super famous artists on there, too.
Super famous what?
Artists.
Oh, yeah. This isn't like little Stickman. Yeah. Beautiful stuff. I mean, look at some of this stuff. This is gorgeous art. Yeah, I use Photoshop to do my backgrounds. I just either do a 4K or an 8K background, and then I feel like I can reuse it forever after that.
Yeah, but you're a PC guy, so.
Well, you know, what is it? GIMP is freaking awesome. It's really cool.
What is?
Oh, GIMP, right? The
oh, yeah, the GIMP, yeah. The GIMP.
So this one's how politics replaced religion in America. And so my thesis here, and I'm, James, I believe you're fairly religious. I'm agnostic myself. I think that religion is an attribute of the person, not the other way around. So there are people who are prone to have a lot of beliefs and things, and there are people who are not. And that's both ways. There's not right or wrong on any of that. I think that once you pull religion out of the public square, the people who are prone to have religion need to hook up with that somewhere or another. And if it's not some sort of established religion, it's going to be their political bent, their identification group. They'll find some way of getting that religious feel that they're doing something, you know, monumentally important.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, I have a guy that I listen to that I would quote here that has a similar premise. He says believe in God or not believing in God or not sure, they're all beliefs.
Right. Yes.
And they're all non-provable, right? And then his saying, which I like, is if you don't believe in God, you'll believe in anything. So you'll replace it, which I'm taking what you're saying is like a different way of saying you replace it with something else.
Yes.
Right, with some other thing that you believe in, some other cause, because people only have causes, right?
So. Well, they do. You know, at some point in your life, probably when you're between 8 and 12, you realize you're not going to be here forever, and you want to feel like you're part of some great big thing that you're making a difference with, and you need some sort of life narrative, and it just that need doesn't go away. You know, people always say this. Think of the wars caused over religion. All the people died. I have been studying history for a long time. I think the Crusades were probably the only huge war caused over religion. Even then, it was just sort of a mix-up between the matriarch and Constantinople. And the Pope, he really wanted money. It's all he wanted. He didn't want, like, all the people of Europe coming down to the Holy Land. So I think that most... Now, I have seen a ton of different conflicts where, like, the Spanish conquistadors, they came here for the gold. Yep. But if you ask them, hey, we're here to, like, you know, help the natives out. And, you know, it's people want to feel like they're starring in their own narrative. But most of the time, they just act in their self-interest and use religion as sort of a...
Sure. I think you probably don't have to compare too many religious wars to what communism has done to the world.
Yes.
And the millions of people killed through, you know, what is the number for the Soviet Union? I think it was like 20 million in Mao. Similar kind of numbers on what they killed, you know, number of people they killed to get people to participate in communism.
Yeah, it's odd. It's an odd discussion to have with people. As an agnostic, it's like, well, guys, if you think that sort of the religious folks are bad, have you looked at the communists? I mean, because they're the ones who said we're going to get rid of all religion, and they're probably the worst ones throughout. You can go back as far as you want to. They're the worst ones about actually killing a lot of people and doing bad things.
Yeah, I would say people should decide on their own.
Yeah. I'm agnostic. I think that the problem we have a lot of times, whether it's UFOs, religion, a ton of different areas, is that we just don't know. And some people are okay with I don't know, and some people are like, nope, I must know something. And so they'll pick yes or no, you know, dang it, no matter what, as long as they know for sure it's yes or no, they don't care, you know, about the actual reasons.
Yeah, okay, well.
Yeah, that's only because I see that in programming. It's just across the board. It's like, well, you know, you try to sell something. Well, it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Or, no, it's wrong. Yes, it's right. It's like, okay, fine.
Well, I used to think I knew everything, Daniel.
When was this?
I learned a lot since then, though.
I've actually reached the point where I know nothing at all. I can parrot things I've heard in the past. And sometimes people think they're my ideas, like, ha, ha, ha. It's like a tape recorder, pretty much. This was an interesting comment to that religion story, which the guy said it actually, as he became a religious on his own journey, he started realizing that, there's a good point here. I thought that was cool.
What was his point?
Well, he was saying... becoming more religious has helped me identify religious tendencies in the secular world. So, you know, as he sort of adopted a religion, he started to see, okay, well, you know, religion's usually self-reinforcing, and there's rules, and there's a hierarchy. There's these things you see in a religion.
Right. We could probably name some of the things going on politically now that you could view as, you know, kind of synonymous with religious belief. But we don't have to go down the path. We could just say that I think I'd agree that that's happening.
Yeah, I think that one of the things the net does is it collapses everything to sort of the shortest answer. And for those folks who like the yes or no, I can't handle ambiguity, you know, they like the net because it speaks to them. But for the rest of it, it's like, well, nah, not so much, right? Okay. This is a good one. Speaking of ambiguity and complexity, this guy wrote a Why OO Matters in F-sharp. And I am torn here, my friend. Torn.
Well, I don't know F-sharp, so...
Okay. So F-sharp does both objects and functional programming.
Yep.
It's modeled after OCaml, and it plugs into the .NET ecosystem. And because of that, first of all, it's probably the best training language for functional programming around because it's a huge community and you can use all the old .NET stuff. But secondly, we get these people coming in from all angles who want to do F-Sharpy stuff, and they come up with these kind of odd conclusions here or there, and you're like, yeah, I kind of agree with you, but no, I think maybe you're not, you know, you're in the wagon, but you haven't driven all the way to town. This guy, he says, hey, you know, objects are actually important, even though F-sharp's considered functional. Here are all the reasons objects are important. And it's like, you know, enabling abstraction, parametric modules. You know, it's motherhood, apple pie. You know, the rings bring forth the flowers in the spring. It's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to take issue with them. But at the same time, it's like I'm not really sure we ended up anywhere useful in this, except for like, hey, objects are better in some cases than functions. And his example that I think probably had the most traction was APIs. And he's like, you know, you have an API to do something and you pass it a parameter. And those parameters tend to grow over time. And so then what do? You have 50 parameters to send to the API. You make a struct. You do a function inside a function with a closure. There are various strategies. And his thing is objects are the best thing for that. And I'm like, I don't know. You know, there's the difference between an API and a library, right? It's like, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But one of the things that stood out here, how far down is it? It's kind of the beginning where he's talking about less experienced developers, and he's making a module API, and then he's got concrete dependencies in there. This is, you know, one of the things that object-oriented, I mean, I'd recommend away. And what this is a problem, which is there's a design heuristic, which is separate object creation from object usage. And so here, you know, this guy's kind of violating that with the concrete dependencies. And he talks about it in this article about, you know, kind of, this is a problem to have the concrete dependencies right there, and that you'd want to, if you had that dependency, you want to feed them in, I suppose, you know. And so that heuristic of separate object creation from object usage is, you know, kind of illustrated here, where they're disobeying it here and where he's a proponent of it later.
Okay, so it struck me as what I would write were I a C-sharp programmer from 20 years ago, learning a functional language and writing it to be an API for other .NET users. Because if you're writing to be an API, then you start thinking in terms of, like, you know, how am I going to group together my functions, what am I going to do as far as persistence, and all of those things lead you right down the OO path.
So does functional mean no persistence?
It's immutable.
Everything is just, okay, does it get saved somewhere? Or?
Well, what that means is that's not part of the discussion. So we have monads or whatever. You have like a special little room for stuff that comes in and out. And that little room has special rules around it. And then once it's in or out, then we do things inside here. Whereas OO is much more like, let's a window here, a door there, we've got those things, and then people can come and see what's in our room. Functions like, no, whatever you're doing, it's really not part of my stuff. So this example he does of email, he's got various ways of doing this. Say you have an email here, and you want it to be a string. And he can be a null, it can be John Smith, it can be Eric@foodbar, whatever. Yeah. And drop table, good old drop tables. He always shows up in these stories. He says, we truly care about illegal states. The obvious alteration of the type would be you have a type. It's a private email string. He puts this stuff together. So here's the thing. This sentence, if we truly care about illegal states, well, why would we care? Because there are different ways of caring, and caring different ways would lead us to different types of code. This is exactly what we're talking about, how you were asking about input-output of functional programming. If I care about whether that string is an email or not, I put it in my input-output stuff, and either it comes in or it doesn't, and I never worry about it again. If I don't care, then it's just it's a variant untyped. I don't care. So, you know, the thing you end up doing when you start thinking in terms of, you start mixing things up, is you say, I want a category of stuff, in this case email, that always will do this blah, blah, blah stuff. And the blah, blah, blah stuff never, ever stays the same over time. And it becomes sort of its own OO spaghetti over time.
if your abstractions don't work.
And see, there's just like
if you don't evolve them to work.
Right. And see, in my case, if I have this thing I want to do in functional programming, and the little door either lets the stuff in I want to do or not, my stuff always works. I never refactor that. Right? Whereas if I'm thinking this universal concept for called email for anybody to use, then I perhaps could be constantly refactoring it. And I'm actually may come up with some rules that don't match these guys over here last week or whatever. TDD, like, I'm not saying this is an unsolved problem by any means. I'm just saying that you have this dependency into the business system by calling email, making this email type, that could lead to a lot of refactoring and screwing around when you might not even need it if you're thinking purely functionally. So it's not that I disagree with him. It's like, well, if you're going to head down this OO API route, then okay, you're correct. But I just don't know why you would want to head down that route.
I can't.
It's one of the interesting things is Don Syme, the guy who actually invented F#. He said, you know, I love this article. He said, I wish you could just say object programming instead of OO, like right here, right. And I thought that was an excellent comment. One of the reasons I included this essay just to bring up Don's comment. And the reason why is OO is all sorts of dang things. It's database design. It's polymorphism. These are things that exist outside of any sort of way. Yes, we can code using OO, but we can also design. We can do analysis doing OO. We can do all sorts of cool OO stuff. I just brought up Photoshop. And so object programming is probably a much better term to use here than just plain OO. I don't disagree with that. I felt like it's like, dude, you're so close. You just haven't made it. This is more. Okay. So some of us, of course not me, have been to Stack Overflow to pull down code they need. I would never, ever do anything like this myself. But I know some other people will just copy stuff and stick it right in there. And so these researchers said, I wonder if we...
You haven't yet today.
I'll never forget when we did the first mob program exercise. The customer's like, do you guys just Google stuff all day long? Like, no, it's very serious. It's a lot of technicals. You wouldn't understand. But anyway, so these researchers said, we can actually go to GitHub and we can
then make it better.
We make it better. So we add the sprinkled magic sauce on top of that. It's what these researchers said.
You got to understand why it works, and then you can make it better. But
I usually spend a couple hours on every little. the thing is, in all seriousness, I'm just trying to poke fun at myself. You have to ask yourself, if you're Googling, whether you're missing something in the language, if you know what you want, you're just missing a language thing, which is most of the times why I Google, or if you don't know what you want and you're looking for some answer to some business problem, you're like, hey, I want to like sort that, and in which case you should probably think back until you should learn enough that you have a tech problem and not you're trying to use the tech to solve business stuff. You see what I'm saying? There's a difference there. I can't remember the Win32 API. I can't remember the different ways to do an algebraic type and...
Why would you bother to memorize all that? I mean,
right.
Unless you're using it every day of every minute of every day.
What you should do, and I think of this as a positive pattern, is you should know what you're coding, and you shouldn't have any doubt about that. And you should get to a point where you go, I know the code does this, but I forgot how. And
But Daniel, you might live in this world where it's possible to know that. So I'll just tell you about my yesterday.
Okay.
I use a popular video service to save videos on. And I'm getting tired of mouse clicking it and having to remember if everything's, been updated and all that kind of stuff. So I want a command line way of uploading. And I want to have a pipeline, basically. If I change a video, it'll go through the process, most of it, and then it will get pushed up with the same ID as the old one and replace the old one. Okay, that's what I want. I have no idea how to do this. And it just so happens, Vimeo has a Python API.
Cool.
All right. And so you can go look at an example, and then you can try to do it. So I have no idea. I know what I want, the business problem I'm trying to solve.
Right.
Maybe I'm agreeing with you on this, then. I don't know.
I think you are.
I know the business problem I'm trying to solve, which is video file needs to replace other video files.
Yes, I got this file. Then, I want to go there.
Yep. And then I know a little bit of Python, enough to be able to take what they put there and pull little chunks out it, see if I understand it, and make it do the thing, all with hard-coded values first, zombie approach. You know, don't get fancy yet.
Yeah.
Hard-code everything. So if I can move file number 14721117 and replace it, right? Ah, and I successfully did that yesterday after, you know, a bunch of attempts of not knowing what the hell I was doing. Ah. But eventually, due to generous people leaving snippets around on places like Stack Overflow, I could figure it out.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you bring up, the Python thing. I think we're very aligned except for the Python. So I would say I got to get this file there from here to there. And I would kind of start there, and I would say, you know, how do I upload a file to Vimeo or whatever, which is actually what I did about a month ago. But
you did it with a mouse, right?
No, but I'm looking to batch this up myself. I'm going down your journey, my friend. I haven't finished the coding yet, so I'm just trying to describe how I'm approaching the same exact problem, right?
Yeah, okay.
So I'm like, I got to move this file from here to there, and I also would love to have a podcast of these videos we do, right? And so the podcast thing was like bizarrely simple. It's just an FFmpeg command. One line, ba-boom, ba-boom, you end up with a video and an audio.
If you can figure out the parameters.
Yeah, parameters. But, you know, actually it's just a hyphen I. You okay. Throw an MP4 at FFmpeg, do hyphen I, an I option, then give it an output as an MP3 file.
There you go.
Yeah, it's all magic. So I had the same question about a month ago, and I thought, well, I will do this using Dropbox because I store things in Dropbox. I could make it so this video goes right to Dropbox, which would be no work at all. And I spent some time with scripting out Dropbox, both on Linux and the Windows. And frack, oh my God, for some whatever reasons, the Dropbox folks are not—they're not happy with you doing it that way. And somebody, I just actually asked on Twitter, I'm like, hey, I'm spending an hour or two trying to see how this code works. I'm not understanding how the code works, which is to your point. I don't understand how it works. And somebody said, look, you don't want to work with Dropbox. Their API just doesn't work that well with file sharing. They never wanted to. And maybe they're afraid that people will genericize their service. So then I'm like, okay, well, let me just see if I can just make the web page for the thing, convert it to two files. And I did. I wrote up a little Bash script, 2-3 lines. It makes the audio, pulls down this spreadsheet we use for our articles, makes it into an HTML table. And I reached the point where it was like, well, that's probably good enough. I will drag and drop those two files for that last little bit of work. However, if I wanted to do the last little bit of work, I found out that Vimeo does upload quite well from Google Drive. And so and you can actually script things out. There's actually a Linux plugin. You can make a folder mapped to your Google Drive, so you just drop things in and call an update function and you're done. I figured out how to do it technically, and I'm like, I put 2-3 hours in this, I'm done. I'm walking away from it. And maybe next month I'll go back and put the Drive part in.
Well, my problem might be a little bit different because sometimes I'll have a topic that I'll do a video and then I want to replace it with a better video and have it appear in all the places that are linked to it. Right, so that video has like a 10-character numeric ID that I have to associate with my source. So I've got other parts of my business problem that, you know, because I don't want to have to remember these connections. Right, I'm not capable of that. So
I'm with you on all that. But my only point was I wouldn't have jumped to the coding language first. I thrashed around some with how to solve this business problem without any sort of tech at all.
Oh yeah, sure.
And then I picked up what I thought was the zero code method, and that that was a false alley. So then I backed up and said, "Let me see what I can do without coding." And during that process, I actually learned how I'm going to finish up the project another week.
Yeah, cool. Well, if you're interested in the Python stuff, I'll show you. It's pretty simple.
I would like to see that. Yeah, and I'll show you my Bash file as well. So let's finish this up here.
If you beat your head against it for a day and a half, it gets really simple.
Yeah, so let me go back to what I was talking about. So that we copy from Stack Overflow. Some researchers said, let's do sort of this massive grep throughout the entire GitHub source base to see who's been using the most little copied pieces of code. And they actually have a ranked list of the most copied pieces of code. And the guy who's number one wrote this blog, and he's like, you know, you've like copied me 35,000 times, and the code's wrong. Oh my God. Oopsie.
So what's wrong with that code? I put a snippet of it into Cyber Dojo. I've got it building and I've got it working, but I'm not sure what's wrong. I couldn't tell.
I got to the point where I got the gist of it. Oh, there's the list of all the different pieces. And the gist of it is it fails on a lot of nines. Basically, yeah, he makes the point. At one point, I was like, it's a double precision issue. And I'm like, okay, I know where we're headed now. We're headed to the fact that at some point the nines roll over and you don't have the number you want. And what you really need to do is, like, once you're so close to the next level unit, you need to start reporting in that unit. So the way his code works is he goes through each little kilobyte, megabyte, gigabyte, and says, hey, is it bigger than this? Is it bigger than that? And if it is, then he just reports in that unit. And that's a good hack, but just it fails when you get to the nines. So where is
off
that?
By one error.
It's a floating point. It's actually a floating point error, which is right. It's off by one, regex, floating point. There's like the same.
Off by 0000001.
Yeah. Well, at this point, we're running the precision limitations of a double. So there's that floating point arithmetic, and I'm like, okay, I've played in this band before, my friend.
Where did floating point even come from in here?
Well, he's using a double.
Math pow. Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Math pow. All right. Which sounds like kung fu, sort of a kung fu move. You know, give him the math pow. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, James.
No, it's okay. Just see where the double came from, but I see it now.
Yeah, if you think about it, really, he's going through the process of reinventing the floating point system because he's trying to use these arbitrarily long numbers and present them in a way that people can read. That's basically what he's doing. So he's going to run into all the floating point problems that we've ever had in the universe, and hopefully he won't keep going. But the first comment on Hacker News was like, hey, I'm the author of number 6 on the list, and boy, it needs some work too. I'm like, shit. What do you do? You like send out an email. Hey, is there a Hallmark card for that? It's like, remember that code you were using? Sorry. I love Stack Overflow for doing what we talked about. However, I have seen wrong answers way, way too many times at the top of the list. And,
Yeah, number 6. Is that going to be your new internet identity?
Number 6? Which you're ranking on Stack Overflow?
No, number 6. So that was your ranking? You were the number 6?
No, this first comment was from D.D. Latham, who's number 6 on Stack Overflow, on the list of top copied pieces of code. Oh. And he's like, hey, my piece of code needs some work too, just like this number 1 guy does. and this is... I hate to harp on a topic, but we just did the email string. You know, do you create a type that everybody uses? Do you create this piece of code that everybody uses, in which case there's these edge cases hopefully nobody cares about? Or do you just say, I want to scope things down to the problem I'm solving right now and not worry about it the rest of the universe?
Yeah.
So you think about it, you put generic code out there, you're taking a lot on, especially in the modern world.
Well, I'm glad people are generous and do that.
I am too.
Usually I find something related to what I need to do, and it's usually enough of a hint to make some progress. But
I found some nice hacks too on Stack Overflow where it's like I would do it one way and like, oh, you just do it like this. That's been pretty cool.
Well, it's funny to go look for ways to do stuff on Bash. how do I isolate the file extension in Bash?
I asked this question myself recently. Did you find an answer?
It's like $ open curly brace, the name of the symbol that you're looking at, pound dot star, of course.
Yes, the old pound dot star.
Or something equally as ridiculous.
I'm okay with like, you know, 5-10 lines of Bash because it keeps me kind of sharp, but I would never write something that like I was like launching nuclear missiles with. Never at all. Because yeah. if you
I did, a,
If you Google Bash, if you Google Bash thing, the comments are all, well, you can't do it that way. The Apostate Conference of 1947, it's all this kind of backstory history. It's like, oh, wow, I've kind of landed in a sort of Bash soap opera.
I tried a little test-driven Bash. And so I wrote this script called Gen X Fakes. And I hopefully don't offend any Gen Xers. It's spelled GEN-X Fakes. When you're programming with C or C++ and you've managed to get the code compiling, but it doesn't link yet, you can take the link map and feed it through a little filter to have a bunch of stubs, test stubs written for you.
Yes. Sure.
That will blow up if you execute them.
That sounds really cool.
Where you got to. It's kind of like creating a whole bunch of breakpoints, all at once, right? So if you get there, it fails a test and, so I did that in Bash, and it's kind of interesting. Although Bash is such a pain to look at. Well, that you have to go relearn it and carefully, understand it again.
The thing about Bash, I finally realized, is Bash is actually not any sort of it's a language, but technically it's just string manipulation. It's just string manipulation. That's all you're doing. You get pipes coming in with strings. You can manipulate the command line with different kinds of strings, a lot of regex. It's all strings.
Yeah. I tend to use it a lot for some of my stuff anyway. But I find if you wrap ideas in functions, that's, the way to sanity.
Yes.
You can make functions in Bash real easily. So.
I've gotten fairly, fairly deep for me. I think I've gone 100, 200 lines at a time. I worry about things like piping things through from one spot to another, and I'm kind of a function in the middle. What do I do if there's an error on either side? I'm uncomfortable with the error handling that I write. I'm sure these signals, there's three different kinds of signals you can receive in a Bash command. The kill 9, kill 11. What are you going to do in response to each one of those?
I'm just not going to cause those to happen. I'll use Control C.
Oh, no, you receive the signal. No, you're the code. You don't get to choose. Yeah, you don't get to choose no kind of thing here, okay?
Yeah, okay.
So all you get to choose is like, well, if they kill you, you're dead. But if they ask you to die, where do you go? Where's the stuff go you're working on?
Yeah. Yeah, well, my scripts tend to be like, boom, just one pass through.
Yes. And I as well, I find that you can with Bash, if you used it, you guys out there have used it before, you can actually end up with this one huge line with pipes. And so I try to get kind of a 120 characters on a pipe, and that's a shell for me. And then I'll just connect up shells. Okay, so one more story here, and then we'll take a look at the code if you want to. This was a great question. How do I get back to employment if I've been working on a bunch of side projects and startups and such? And there's good advice here for folks who are interested in this. But the reason I included this one guy goes, I list my job title as failed internet billionaire. I'm like, whoa, I found my new title. He said it gets a laugh, and he can include all the stuff he's been working on, and people look at it.
That's pretty good.
I like it.
Because you want to work with people with a sense of humor.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I might actually try that next time I actually send a CV out to anybody, which is kind of rare for me, but I might. and the next up is this actual link if you're interested in the 10 engineering jobs he's holding at one time. So, James, you want to show me your Python thing, and I will show you my Bash before we leave here?
Oh, yeah, sure. Let's see if I've got it here.
Now, when I bring up VS Code, we may hang for 5 or 10 seconds, but we'll come back.
Yeah, okay. So I should share my screen?
Yeah, you're on.
All right. So let me do a share here. And we'll share a window, and it'll be this window right here. All right, let's see.
Ah.
Can you see some code?
I can. Actually, it's quite readable.
For some reason, I don't get to see it, but...
Hang on. 1 second. It's quite readable, but I'm not looking at the thing we're sending out here. This is what we're sending out. I think that'll work.
Okay. So this is all just kind of discovering how to do it. I haven't turned it into the thing that I need yet completely, but there's some stuff you have to do at Vimeo to get your secret access token and secret client, your client secret and your client ID, some stuff you need. And then they have to approve you if you're going to upload files, which they say takes 5 days and they only took one. It was kind of making me mad that I was in the middle of this problem and it gave me back a message saying, you don't have the permission to do the thing you're doing. It's like, well, wait a second. It's my account. Why don't I? And then it's going to take me 5 days to get it. But then they somehow did the miracle and got it done in one day, even though they said there's no way they would be able to.
Now, did you go – there's like a page on Vimeo for like developer tokens to start you off?
It's a developer page. And actually, this code is right there. But, you know, you grab it, you got to go see what it does. So I took this first little thing here. You know, can I run this thing and get back the about me?
Oh, cool.
Thing, which is kind of cool because this worked like right away, and this was pretty much straight out of the web page. Okay, and there's a bunch of words here, and you know they kind of assume that you know something about what they're talking about. So there's like reading between the lines you have to do, which is why it takes a day to do what I did instead of 5 minutes. Yeah. And then to upload a video, you can. I wrote this little function here, which uses their Vimeo API, this VDOT. That's my instance of my Vimeo client. And so I can upload a video, brand new video. And
pretty straightforward.
Then the video's uploaded, right? So basically my process involves making a recording on my Linux machine, moving it over to my Mac to edit, rsyncing that the outputs of those back to the Linux box, which will then run an audio... normalizer on all the files and stamp them with a date code so that you can tell when there's a new one. And then what the next step of this process will be that it's going to notice when there's new ones and shove them up to Vimeo. If it's a replacement of the old one, it'll have to have this metadata, which is about the ID that Vimeo knows it by, which is the second thing, replace video. And so you need to know what a video ID is, and you don't have a video ID until you've already uploaded one, and I don't know how to get that programmatically, but I don't really care about that.
Probably so a catalog. There's probably a catalog function that you search by.
Yeah, I haven't looked for that yet, but I might, or I just might. You know, that's a one-time thing I have to do every time I invent a new video, so it's like not that big of a deal. And then you tell, where can you find the MP4 and what's its title and description, so you put all the metadata. Well, it's two calls. One is to replace the video, and the other is to change its name and stuff if I care about doing that. So I just figured as long as I'm here, why not do that? It's kind of maybe extra that I didn't need, but and here's my first trial, and I mentioned hard coded everything. Oh. I happen to have a video named 441 blah 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 blah.
Oh.
And I
bet you that also Vimeo has a number at the end of the URL when you upload, so I bet you it's right there in the URL.
Yep, it's right there in the URL. Yeah. So somebody could go find that video. Well, they won't be able to see it because you have to have my secret link to get to it. And then the name of it and other stuff. So there's a couple things I can do there to tag it. And so at any rate, this is the discovery part of what do I need, and then it's going to have to get turned into this. The next step is to automate that pushing of all that stuff up to. When I run the script, basically.
Well, I hate to say it, but I don't hate that much to say it. This is, you're pretty much posting out, you could do this all in Bash. It doesn't look like there's anything that's necessarily complex enough.
Are you looking at the developer page?
No, I'm imagining this JSON you're packaging up to send out, which probably just end up being a command line parms.
Definitely. Yeah. So there'll be a little bit of Bash probably that surrounds this, or maybe it'll just be a little Python script that goes and looks at the directories, So
I ran into the same issue using Trello, the cardboard. We move cards across different lanes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Part of my second book was what's the simplest way of writing a project management system? And the answer was, you write a notepad saying, here's my task, I'm done or not. And then I wrote a quick program that concatenated all that stuff, then synchronized a Trello board to see whether you're done or not. And it was same thing. I had to get a token, I had to get approval. And then, to be honest, the toughest part was once I got in, the help files were like a bazillion different options for everything imaginable. And I'm trying to go through wanting to do something simple. That was.
So here's where the working example of anything comes in handy, which is, you know, if you have a working example of uploading something, you can take that and morph it slowly, carefully into exactly what you need. You know, it's kind of like taking Hello World and then building, you know, an AI voice response system, right? You start with Hello World and you keep changing it a little bit, and turn it into this other bigger thing, you know. So that's been my go-to. Yeah, it's easier to keep a system working than to fix it after you break it.
I completely agree. I think this is also a good example from that OOFP discussion that you kind of bailed out a little bit on. But this is an API, and you get permission to use the API, which is the token and the OAuth, whatever. It's two things. And then you call functions in the API that take a couple of variables. Now, this is JSON, so they could make these things huge, you're calling. But for most cases, you just need a variable or two. And for most cases, as we just pointed out, you can probably just send it just an HTTP GET and do it without any coding at all.
Yeah.
And that's the way Trello was. If I wanted to, and actually that's how I ended up doing it, to be honest. I was going to code it in F#. Then I realized, well, hell, this is all just a couple of variables and a couple of gets, and that's what I ended up doing. And I was very happy doing that.
Oh, yeah. So they show you how to do it with, you know, your get URLs and stuff like that. But I like the fact that they have Python means I can just worry about the part that I care about.
Yes. Yeah, the thing is, you got in, you solved the problem, you got out, and what I always ask people is, where do you spend your time trying to solve a problem? Are you like discussing the tools and the framework and all that? In which case, the tools own you; you don't own the tools. Mm. Or you just get in, get out, and you're done? And in which case, you're actually using a tool the way you're supposed to.
Cool. Yeah, well, they went to the trouble of making a Python API, so it's like, okay, I like doing this kind of stuff in Python, so.
Well, I think part of the thing is that it's like French, Russian. You try to find something, a language people speak, to give them information. And then if they know how to translate already, then that's fine. I don't know Python. To be honest, I don't think I've ever coded maybe 20, 30 lines of Python. Not a lot. I was able to follow along just fine.
I wouldn't say that I know Python either. But if there's any Python programmers out there looking at this, I don't claim to know Python. I can get Python to do things for me.
Yeah.
And then when my friend Tim Ottinger looks at it, he'll say, oh, that's great that works. He's such a nice guy. And he goes, here's what a Python programmer would do.
Yeah, Tim, you should go talk to the Bash guys there. they got a bunch of it. Tim is, you're right, Tim is probably the nicest technical coach I've ever worked with. I strive to be more like Tim, but that's funny. I think that once you really adopt the language, it's tough to look at code in that language without going, no, wait a minute, this, even if it's fine, you're still like, no, just get to move this over here. It's in the wrong spot.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that C programmers do that always bothers me is like if you've got a Boolean expression that you want a function to do, you know, I'll just say return A equals 42, right? And then, so like the function's name is A 42 or something like that. You know, so the function encapsulated this question, and you can just return the result of the Boolean operation. Yeah. And a lot of people feel compelled to say if the result of this, then return true, else return false. It's like
if answer equals true, return true. False, return false.
Right. And so I keep encouraging them. It's like, you know, you must be programming by yourself a lot or something, you know, because if you're doing this, because you think that's necessary, right? You know, idiomatic C, you know, the way people that know C would do this is different than what you're doing, you know, so.
When I code F sharp,
it's good that your code works, by the way. But you might want to do it like this instead.
Yeah, if I were a real C programmer, I might would.
All right, you were going to show me something. What are you going to show me?
Can you wait 10 seconds? I've had to move it up here on a server here.
Yeah. Take off this hat, then.
I shall return.
So if this camera's still live here, hopefully Daniel's going to edit this out. But if not, I'll give you a little lightning show. There's some lightning from a friend of mine. And I think he's in Arizona. That's where his lightning comes from. Some of the fires that come in handy, when you're talking about bad things that happen in programming, it might be a ground fire or just a side fire. Sometimes dragons come and blow huge plumes of fire. And, the tedious task of debugging and getting the last of the fire out. And, sometimes it turns into a huge firefight. And, hopefully it doesn't end like that. Yeah, let's get back to... hard to go the wrong way. Well, Dan, I've just been entertaining myself here while you've been gone.
I had to put it on a thumb drive because if your network's unplugged, it's not going to actually work.
All right. I've been entertaining myself with my backgrounds and talking to the camera. I don't know if you're recording still.
Oh, yeah. Why not? Bits are cheap, my friend.
I gave a tour of my fires.
Where'd you get this? Is that the Camtasia stuff?
I think so, yeah. I think those came from Camtasia. You've got your basic ground fire, or you've got a fire coming from the side, and then you've got your dragon fire. Where's the dragon fire? Come on.
Oh, cool.
Dragon fire. And then your end of the debugging. You got, your life isn't completely in danger now, but you still got to get rid of it. And then there's serious debugging here where... And then hopefully in the end, it's not like that, Everything comes burning down.
That's wild.
All right, okay. Back to you.
All right, we'll see if this... So basically I have this spreadsheet I put up that has our list of our links, comments I made, why are we showing this in the title of the link. And I wanted to put it up on this. I had been making a table and entering things in a table, and I'm like, hey, I've already got this spreadsheet on Google. I want to automate the whole thing. I want the Google spreadsheet to come down. I want to make an HTML table out of it. Then I want the processing to work on the audio and video. I want it all. And so what I did first was I made this little bash script, and I found there's 100 ways to do this. You could take an HTML table, has a prefix and a suffix, begin table, end table,
right.
And then a bunch of rows in the middle. So you could loop through things. There's a bunch of different ways to do this. And I decided I'll just use a here doc in Bash and just because I'm not going to change this stuff anytime soon. So I just actually hard-coded that rascal right in there to the bash thing.
There you go.
So I have an incoming file here, which is defaults to in.tsv if I don't provide anything. Outgoing defaults to out.htmlfrag if I don't provide any variables there. And then this here doc actually takes all this stuff to up to EOF and puts it in the variable top table part. And then I do the same thing with bottom table part right here. So now yep. I've got two variables in Bash that describe the top and bottom of the table. And I've got a file I downloaded from Google Drive that's separated by tabs, the fields. And then it's just a matter of echo the top table part to the file. And then I append right here. Here's the append right here. The append is an awk. It's an awk. And so basically I just print out the table. There's the table word right there.
There you go.
And I do an append operation to the outgoing file. And then when I'm done, I add the bottom part in. And bada boom, bada bing. Now I don't have to type in those stupid things on the HTML spread table every week. And then the...
there you go.
Like I said, the video conversion is just a hyphen I. And then I've already got a script that uses Google Drive. You can actually mount Google Drive and just X copy things to it. I just haven't set it up yet. And it goes up to Google Drive. And then from Vimeo has an API that can transfer from Google Drive. And then you're not moving tons of bits all over the place.
And then does Vimeo just know to go look there for
yes.
it? Or do you have to... So it's automatic that it'll find it when you add new content?
What happens is that from the web page, there's a upload from Drive option that just brings up your Drive folder. You pick the file. But then I'm sure the API exposes this similar. That has to be what they're using in the web page.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, cool.
So, yeah, I reached a point where the rest of the solution wasn't that hard. I know what I want to do. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm no longer motivated anymore. So yep. let me finish this one out, James.
The next time you'll be motivated is if you have to make a change to it.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Well, at some point I'm going to get tired of like having to type, like, I don't know, like drag and drop's going to get old. Okay. I'm Daniel Markham. You have wasted yet another hour that you could have been learning like to be a surgeon or something useful with your life. But no, you had to drop by and talk to us about all kinds of really cool stuff. And we're happy that you did. I hope you've enjoyed today. I hope you learned some stuff. And I will see you on the internet.